Hi, my name is Rebecca. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I would just like to remind the attendees that the special needs seating sections are exclusively for those who are in some way handicapped. We'll now have a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. I just want to say hello to Toledo, because these people are so excited. And I want to say hello to New York, which is where I'm from. And thank you so much to Toronto, which is where Sean is from. I also personally want to thank Doug R. For those of you who know him, he's just a wonderful man, and he coordinated this whole entire thing. And I am so grateful that he asked me to have the honor and the privilege of being in front of you here. And I'm also just tremendously grateful for the amount of work he put in so that all of us could be here and share this. So, Doug R. And I just wanted to also say that from up here, you guys clean up pretty good. Everybody just looks so happy, and, you know, riding on those escalators has been so amazing, just seeing all these faces just beaming, and I, for one, am thoroughly enjoying myself, which is something that I couldn't really do too much at the end of my drinking. So I'm just so happy to be here. And our first speaker tonight, or today, excuse me, is Sean, and he's from Toronto, and he actually went to his, he got 12 steps 28 years ago today. So, Sean.
I got a little bit of a shake. I'm so happy, because I wasn't nervous before, and I'm really nervous when I'm not nervous, because there's something wrong. I'm supposed to be nervous up here a little bit. My name is Sean. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Shepherd Group here in Toronto. And I'm also very pleased to be here. And it's been a wonderful experience to see so much success in the lives of the people that are around here, you know. It's just driving through Toronto and seeing all the people on the street, seeing you here, walking up and down, it's just doing something to my heart. Even last night, I tell you, it was just, as the song said, I scarce can take it in, you know. It was just so great to see all those people there. And there was a couple of moments in last night when she was singing Amazing Grace at the end of it, and when they introduced the Chinese flag and a few things like that were just so overwhelming, you know. But the big secret is that we're just here, the very fact that we're here. And our topic being the willing to believe. You know, I rarely talk about God when I talk, you know, because for me, Alcoholics Anonymous has always been the evidence of the people that are here. There's lots of people in my life who have a great faith and stuff like that, and now, in my sobriety, I've been blessed with that too, but not always, and I'll get to that in a moment. But for me, I've rarely talked about God when I speak in AA, because it's being present. Just being present, being here, sober present, is 90% of the program for me. Just to see you there. All the words you say in the world, you know, they're great, they're just a little bit of icing on the cake and that, but just being here, and the one-on-ones, and when things get rough, you know, it's nice that we're having a nice time, because we need this, you know, you need the boost, and stuff like that, but it's the day-to-day living that the program is lived in, you know, and that's when your friends are here, and we see each other, and we live the program. I go to my home group, and I walk in there every Tuesday night. I never miss it, and that's something has to be something very, very special for me to miss my home group. It's the same faces, we're a few newcomers, and that's what it's about. Anyways, I was going to tell you a brief part of my story, and I'll try and keep the evidence on the spiritual side of it, although there was very little of that in my actual drinking days. I am the youngest of 12 children, actually. 11 of us reached adulthood. I grew up in Dublin. And of the 11 children who reached adulthood, 8 of us are alcoholics. And my father was an alcoholic. Now, the good news is, of the 8 of us who are alcoholic, 6 of us got sober and are sober. One of them died, actually, a few years ago. Another one is dying right now, but he's sober, and one who died is sober. I have a brother just older than me who came to AA, went to treatment. He's a couple of years older than me, figures, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I want to live the life. And he's doing it. And he's getting by somehow. He's getting by, and I wouldn't want to live the life he lives, but he somehow gets by. I have another sister who was 15 years sober in AA and went back drinking 8 years ago in Dublin, and she's living the alcoholic nightmare to its extreme worst. It's just a horrible situation, and, well, we know the story. There's some things we can't do anything about. We do the best we can, but we can't. But the other 6 of us are sober, the 5 of us living, and I have a brother speaking in half an hour over in the Royal York, so he's active in AA here in Toronto also. That's been very good. I think growing up in that family, it was a good family. There wasn't a lot of money around at the time. My father got sick just after I was born, so there was no abuse of alcohol. I grew up in an environment where alcohol is acceptable. I didn't see too much drunkenness, but going to the pub was acceptable. And you didn't hear much talk about alcoholism. I didn't see any violence from alcoholism, any of that, but no doubt we suffered it. An alcoholic has a certain personality, and then we suffer because of that personality. I came to Canada when I was 18 years old. I'd already started drinking by then. It's my belief that the alcoholic gene is close to the surface of me. Some of my older brothers could drink a 40-pounder and a 24 a beer, and you wouldn't know they were drinking. I wasn't one of those, maybe because I was further down the line, I start drinking, you know, you give me a bottle of booze and a couple of pints. I was very drunk, you know. But I love booze from the very beginning. When I was 6 or 7, I'd be going around the tables when people had their backs turned. I'd be drinking their gin and tonics and sipping it, not drinking it, sipping it. And then in my early teens, I went to boarding school. I was an altar boy. I started drinking the altar wine then, but it was just more cheeky, you know, in your face. You know, the priest turns his back, you take a shot. And just to prove you could do it. At 13, I didn't need a drink in the morning. That didn't happen until 20. But anyway, so there was that part of it. And then when I was my first drunk, I was 18. I was working in Dublin and finished high school. I had gone into town at Christmas with the older boys drinking. I had enough money to buy all the booze I wanted to, and I did. And I was drinking glasses of brandy and pints of Guinness. On the way home that night on the bus, I was thinking, what a wonderful night I've had, you know. And with that very thought, I threw up all over the bus. I proceeded to stagger up the street, sleep in the chicken coop, ruin my clothes, puke, scratch my face, go into the house, break my mother's heart, and the next morning, Christmas morning, not eat any food on Christmas Day. And that was Christmas Eve for the next 12 years. Just in different countries and different places. And that was my drinking style. I was a drink to pass out or fallen down drunk or getting into trouble. I was not a respectable drunk. I was a fallen down drunk. And my story took me. I came to Canada. And here in Canada, I joined the army. I was kicked out of the army. I went to the bush to try and make money to go to university, which I did. I went to jail just for a night before I was 21, for drinking in northern Canada. I went back to Ireland to go to university. I was already at 21. I was already a chronic alcoholic. I used to pass out in my classrooms. And actually, I have something in common with Bill Wilson. I was drunk writing my exams. So so that wasn't a good year. And as a matter of fact, I'd really like to go back and get the results of that year to find out if I passed any of those exams. Because I don't remember. I just don't remember. I came back to Canada. I came to the States and up to Canada then for a while. I'm just traveling around trying to find myself. I lived in Atlantic City and I nearly drank myself to death at 22 in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Some guys threw me on the bus, sent me back to Toronto, and my sister nursed me back to health. I went back to Ireland for 4 years. I figured I couldn't be an officer and a gentleman. I couldn't be a scholar. I'd be a patriot. So I went back to Ireland, to free Ireland, and and all I did was drink. And broke my mother's heart. I was a smoker. I set everything on fire that I've ever touched. Everything. I passed out so often. And the amazing thing about the human body is I've only one scar left where I actually cooked myself one time. I set a couch on fire, and it was a low smoldering fire, and it actually cooked my right hip. But there's only one scar about the size of a loony, a Canadian loony, on my hip. And it's an amazing thing about the human body, our ability to recover. Anyways, I came back to Canada. My family wanted to get me out of Ireland because it was just 4 years of 22 to 26 and just drunk all the time. Falling down drunk, getting in trouble, fighting. I used to fight too. I've always hated myself as a kid. And I was always less than I expected. I had 7 older brothers who were very talented, and I didn't have their talents. I wasn't as smart, as educated, as handsome, as tall, as whatever. I really disliked myself. And the psychiatrist once told me I drank to drown the anger, you know. And the problem is, that only works for a while, because the anger comes through, and then you're in real trouble. Because now you're drunk and angry. And I used to do some wild stuff, you know. I would attack the biggest guy in the bar and all that kind of thing. And the only reason I'm still here is they had mercy on me. Or else I'd fall down before I hit. That literally happened a number of times. I'd actually go to attack some bouncer, and I'd fall down before I got to him. Once or twice, though, a funny twist of fate happened. Once or twice, I actually kept my muscle coordination, and I could have gotten a lot of trouble. I was in blackouts and brawls, and I found out later that they were very nasty. I'm just lucky to be here. Anyways, I was back here. I lived rough on the streets here in Toronto for a while, and then I pulled up myself up on my bootstraps, went out west to the Canadian Arctic for a year, got cleaned up a little bit, ended up in Edmonton, and back to the old style. But then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in January of 77. I figured I stayed around for a couple of months, looked at you guys, figured I wasn't as bad as any of you guys, went back out there. But on just this weekend, I phoned one of the guys. I had a blackout the night before. When I got up in the morning, I phoned one of you, an AA guy, and he came. He 12-stepped me Saturday morning, Canada Day weekend, 28 years ago. And that was quite the experience for me. And so I want to talk about something I don't normally do, as I say, talk about the spiritual aspect of this program, which is even, I guess the reason, even the word the spiritual aspect doesn't sit with me very well, because it's all spiritual. We're just evidence of a spiritual happening. We're just an energy, you know, and it's always been like that. Growing up, my mother was quite a religious woman. She had a great faith at two levels. She had a faith that was absolute, that there is a heaven, and she's going to go there, and God will look after all the serious problems. And she worried like crazy about the small stuff. And that was a little bit of what I have too, and everything else. When it gets into really serious situations, you know, people like, just have to have a lot of people dying recently and stuff like that, and one of these brothers dying with cancer at the moment. I have no problem with those things. Just no problem at all. I just absolute faith they're going to a better place, and it's just a confidence that just there isn't even any question about it. It's just it, you know, see you later kind of stuff. And I lost one of my closest friends in AA on April the 30th, Susan, you know, and absolute that she's there watching, and we'll see her later, and that's all there's to it. So there's nothing even more to talk about that. It's in the other stuff, in the day-to-day living, that I sometimes get in trouble. Anyway, growing up in this big family and seeing it and going to church and getting a lot of catechism and education, I have a lot of religious education. But I was 10 years old. I knew at 10 years old that I didn't believe in God. I consciously didn't believe in God, and I knew that. I wasn't particularly bright or anything else, but when people would be talking about it, I said, I don't believe that. And I don't know why. And I kept my mouth shut about it. Then I was educated by priests in a boarding school at junior 8. We were meant to go on to be priests. So I got a lot of religious training. And I didn't believe. Now, the thing is, willing to believe is such a good topic, because I always wanted to believe. Because even at 10 years old, I could tell that the people who believed were better off than the people who didn't. I could tell that. I didn't know why, but I could tell. And so that was my story in through my high school years and that. Of course, I started drinking, and I was a serious alcoholic by 21. I remember when I went back to Ireland at that time, I remember sitting in a bar, age 23. I remember this quite clearly. And I was thinking, half in the bag, I was thinking about this thing about God and my no faith and trying to figure out the existence of God. And I had a thought that I can't figure this out. To heck with it. I'm not going to bother with it anymore. I later learned in my religious studies later on that that's a very dangerous attitude to take in your spiritual life, because it can lead you to all kinds of bad psychological situations. But I was fortunate, but I just turned it off. Now, I continued on with my drinking career and until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But here's a funny twist also. I didn't believe, I wanted to believe, but I often went to church on Sunday. Now, I'd often be hungover, and I could only stay for 5 or 10 minutes because I'm too sick to stay in the church, right? And I'd go back out and I'd puke up against the church wall and that kind of stuff. But I often went. A psychiatrist told me later what that was about. He said, alcoholics are extremely insecure people. And we always want some things that we can hang on to that are consistent and the same. And the Catholic Church in Mass is the same all over the world. It's the same procedure. And it gives you confidence in a crazy place that there is some stability. Because I couldn't see it in myself or in anything else. So that was that aspect of it. I got sober in AA, and when I came here, I did not believe. As a matter of fact, consciously I couldn't believe, but I must have believed down deep because I couldn't say the word God. When I'd be reading this, I could read it in the preamble or something, or in the, you know, how it works. I could say God if I read it. But I couldn't generate within me the word God. It just wouldn't come past my throat. The same way as when I came into AA first, I couldn't say the word alcoholic. The word alcoholic would not go past my vocal cords for 6 weeks before I could say it. So I say to you, I didn't believe in these and I'm not affected by it, but obviously something very deep was going on inside. So the old timer said to me at the time, well, just come to AA, trust that we know how it works and that we get sober. And I did. You know, it was the big thing that happened to me in AA was, I think I used to figure I had no abilities, no talent, I wasn't very smart and all the rest of that. But the amazing thing was, the first great talent and gift that came to me was, I trusted you. Now, not a lot of people trust other people. Now, I didn't trust you individually, and my first sponsor, Chuck C. out in Everton, said, never trust an alcoholic as an individual basis, trust it as a group. He says, we all have clay feet. And that was one of the best things he ever said. I've never been disappointed by an alcoholic in 28 years, because I never expected it to be perfect. I expect us as a group to be perfect, but not as an individual. So I've not been surprised by some of the things that have happened in AA. Anyways, so I stayed around here for a while, and what they told me was, eventually it'll connect to you. And I was about 18 months sober. I went to church with a brother of mine visiting in Calgary, Alberta. And I was sitting in there, and there was about 400 people in the church, and I was going through I'm an accountant by training. I went back to school and studied accountancy when I sobered up. And although I don't do it now, I'll get back to that too in a moment. And I was counting the numbers, and I think it's about 400 people, you know, in the church. I said, if 10% of these people are sincere, it means there's 40 people in here really believe there's a God and they can be in contact. And that was an amazing thing. It was such a good thought. I said, I won't screw this up by thinking about it. I'll put it on the back burners for 90 days and I'll take it out and I'll review it after 90 days. And I did. And that was the beginning and the opening for me. I went back to my group in Edmonton and I did all the things that I was supposed to do. I did the steps AA was my higher power, and I just trusted things like borrow somebody else's higher power, become willing to believe. I heard this when I was 7 years sober, by the way. I heard a guy saying, and I had come to believe by then, I heard a guy saying something that was magic to me. He says, I heard him say to a newcomer, you don't have to believe. Just think if it might be true. Don't think that it's true that there's a God that loves you and wants the best for you. Just think that it might be true and what it would mean if it was true. You know? So like there's no bonus. You don't have to make him a commitment on that basis. But it's a great thought. And I got great comfort from that because I could do that without making a commitment. But still it got me on the path. Anyways, I was very fortunate. There was three priests in my home group in Edmonton. One of them died within the first year. He couldn't get sober. He died within the first year. The other two are still sober. But one of the priests was very good. And I figured, I made a choice that I'm in AA, but I'll go back to the church of my youth because I did have a lot of knowledge about it. And I did go back to the church of my youth, and I was transferred to Vancouver. I remember one time I called this priest back and says, "How you doing, Sean?" I said, "I'm having a lot of trouble with this church and what they teach us in church and that." And he says, "Particularly about Jesus." And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I just can't get my head around it. But I'd like to believe it." And he says, "Well, just tell him that and let him do the rest, you know?" And it's great AA wisdom, you know. This was a guy just not laying anything on me. Just give it over and let him do the rest. And that worked for me. You know, that has worked for me since then. Okay. I continued on. I went back and I searched all the religious quests, and it worked. I learned lots of stuff and got lots of intellectual information. For a while, I used to go to an AA on a Sunday morning, go to an AA meeting. I would go to one of the Pentecostal meetings because they had a great faith message and I didn't have one. And I go to my own Catholic Church Mass. I did that for many years in Vancouver. I see Danny, my old sponsor there, he was around at the time, you know. And all of that stuff together worked for me. What has happened since then is it has distilled in me this basic inner faith. I enjoy the church in all churches. I enjoy anybody that goes to a church. I think they're winners. And I enjoy all religions and all information. I've been blessed that way. My faith today is, it's like the tide. It goes in and out. But I don't worry about when the tide is out now because it's happened so often. I know it's coming back again, right? And when it comes back again, it'll be stronger than ever. Now, I'm going to tell a little story about when I said I'd come back to that dome. I had lost all the confidence that I could do anything in my life because of my drinking. Really shattered my ability to trust myself. As an accountant with a crane company, I got into the crane business, and then I got into the operations and marketing end of it. I came back from Vancouver in 1987, and I was working for a crane rental company here. And most of the lifts that you see in the dome where we were last night, I don't know if this is good news for you or bad, but I put them up there. You know, this was a skid row alcoholic, you know. And we come back, and a lot of those lifts were quite tricky, and it was working with the people who designed it and that, but the rental cranes, I looked after it. That's a long ways from being sleeping down the back alley, is over there in Dundas Street West, and it was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. My name's still Rebecca. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Oxford Group. It meets on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in New York City. And you're all welcome there anytime you're in New York. However, I got sober in Colorado at the campus group in Fort Collins. And some people from that group are here today. And what I was thinking about just now about willing to believe is that when I got here, I was really crazy and really angry. And I sat in the back, and my arms were permanently crossed, and I had long hair, and I wore baseball hats, and I wore my father's and my brother's thrown-out long-sleeve flannel button-down shirts and big jeans. And I was not psyched to be hanging out with you guys. And, you know, I wasn't what I thought an alcoholic was. I was a girl, and I was 21, and I did not think that that's what an alcoholic was. And I started going to this meeting, the campus group, and for me, somewhere around 6 months after going to that group and going to AA, I fell in love with AA. And my love affair with AA is still going on right now. We've had definitely our ins and outs, but I have not fallen out of love with you yet. And I really, even at the beginning, I believed that it was working for you. And that made me curious to come back until I really fell in love. And I was in love with getting drunk. In love with getting drunk. And I have to tell you that today I'm more in love with being sober than I ever was with being drunk. At that very first meeting that I went to about 8.5 years ago was your next speaker, who is my dear, dear friend Jim, who I just love. So, you know, the woman Jeannie from Vermont didn't show up, but Jim has been showing up for me for a long time. So this is Jim.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. This is really an honor for me. I certainly didn't expect this when I left from Fort Collins a few days ago to come out here. I've known Rebecca since our first meeting, and everything she says about her love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous is true. And I've always had a lot of respect for her in that. So we have to talk about willingness to believe here. I'd like to start out with a little bit about my story. I was sober for 12 years, and then I turned 13. And I still remember my first drink. I don't know. They say that if you remember your first drink, you probably had a problem way back then. And you know, one thing I'd like to add here before I get going here is I know that since I'm a little unprepared for this, I know that that I'm going to try and speak the language of the heart here for you people, because we all know and understand each other, and that's the thread that binds us together. So I had three beers and when I turned 13, and I still remember that half a six pack I drank with a friend of mine. And, you know, from then it was just, my father died from this disease, and I never wanted to be like him. And my whole drinking career, and we do call it a career here, that seems to be, other people don't speak of their drinking as a career, and we have all put a lot of energy and a lot of time and to cultivate this wonderful disease of alcoholism. So I got drafted into the Army when I was in 1966, and I got married while I was in the Army. And when I got out, I went to school, and you know, it didn't take me long to drink through that marriage. My wife was a really wonderful person, and I should have realized that, you know, when I was going with her, that getting drunk with her father wasn't really a good thing. We did that several times at the local bar, and, you know, we'd both come back to their house, you know, drunk, and, you know, it was okay, I guess, you know, but, you know, that was one of the big amends I had to make in this program when I finally got my head on straight. So my big thing was drinking and driving. I had a few DUIs. My second DUI was I was at the bar the night before. You know how we can be really helpful to other people. I got really drunk and decided I was going to drive this other person home. It was his vehicle. It was really strange to me. And the next day he brought me back to the bar. A woman, this was like 8 o'clock in the morning, and I had a beer and a kamikaze sitting in front of me, and a woman came in that was out of gas, and I had just filled my car with gas, so I siphoned a gallon of gas out, and I had a long beard at that time, and I got gas all over my, you know, when you're siphoning gas. And I went to fill her car to put this gallon of gas in her car, and in the meantime, the highway patrol had set up a safety check up the road, and I put the gas in her car, and unbeknownst to me, they set the safety check up, and I turned around, and they pulled me over right in front of the bar that I was just came from. And of course, I hadn't had much to drink that morning, but I had a half a bottle of scotch the night before, and they pulled me over, and taking the roadside tester, and my friends are looking at me out of the window of the bar. They didn't realize it was me until I took 10 steps forward and came back the other way, and they said, oh, wow, you know, they picked me. So I went to take the breath test, and, you know, the breathalyzer doesn't know the difference between methyl alcohol and ethyl alcohol. So the last thing I had on my breath was gasoline, and I blew pretty high. You know, it was probably 87 octane, and I I couldn't really. So my big defense was, you know, I'm gonna get out of this one, even though I was drunk from the night before. I took this to a jury trial. And of course, I couldn't find the woman who I siphoned put the gas in her car. The only bit of evidence I had was this piece of hose that I'd used to siphon the gas. And of course, like a good alcoholic, before the case went to court, I went out and got really drunk the night before, and showed up in a nice pinstripe suit, but just reeking of alcohol from the night before. And the jury looked at me and said, you know, how many shots of gasoline would it take for him to be in that condition? Because the officer obviously realized I was pretty drunk. And they really nailed me. I got 12 points so I think I lost 24 points. They gave me an illegal U-turn and just absolutely threw the book at me. So, you know, one of my favorite things to do is when I would get these things, when this would happen to me, I would go back to the bar and go, you know, poor me, and I would get drunk again, and poor me, you know, it's happened to me again, life is not fair. So, you know, that was my kind of my, the last hoorah that got me here was I was in a head-on collision at like 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and fortunately I didn't hurt this person badly, but I had always told myself that I was going to run from the scene of the accident, because I'd been drinking for like 3 days, and if this happened to me again. So after the accident, I went up and asked the person in the other car if they were okay, and he said, my leg hurts, and I said, well, let me go get help. And I had no intentions of going back. I took off and went down to the local 7-Eleven store there, and I watched the ambulance go by. And I watched the highway patrol go by, and all the sirens are going, and I know where these people are going. I'm like watching it from sitting on the curb there, trying to drink some coffee to sober up. And fortunately, I went back, and I went back to the scene. And it was the same officer that had arrested me 7 years prior. With this jury trial thing I'm telling you about, this is the same guy. And he said, don't I know you from somewhere? And I said, no, I don't think so. And, you know, if you'd have looked at me sitting in the back of that squad car, I would have absolutely told you that this is the worst day of my life. Bar none. This is why should something like this happen to a person like me? And, you know, as it turned out, it was the best day of my life, because it's what got me into this fellowship. I went to treatment after that. Well, first thing I did was got an attorney. And I still hadn't come to believe at this point in time. I was still very selfish and self-centered. And I went to treatment, and well, my attorney said, if you can get some treatment, maybe we can get you a deferred sentence on this. And I know, you know, I was .285. That, you know, I was right. I was up there, alcohol wise, and plus the accident, and that was at a period of time when they were really starting to crack down on DUIs around Colorado. And I went to treatment, and I went to treatment in a place called Harmony up in Estes Park, and you know, it's only about 45 minutes away from where I lived. And I didn't really realize that they had such world-class treatment so close to my house. And I walked in there and saw all those students sitting there, and I went, wow, is this really me? Am I really an alcoholic? And I couldn't really put a meaning on that word at that time, because, it was kind of like I wanted to get this over with. I wanted to get this accident out of the way. And in the meantime, you know, I didn't know whether this guy was going to sue me for everything I had. And I just thought about, you know, I want to get back on the street and get this deferred sentence. And fortunately, while I was there, I saw that I had a problem with alcohol. And I was very relieved. I was very relieved that I didn't have to live like that anymore, that I didn't have to spend all this energy and time and money and everything that, you know, was making me, was killing me. And it was killing me, and I couldn't see it. And so that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, was when I was at that treatment center. And there was so much spirituality in that place. They had a place, a room there called the Bob Dean Room. And this whole facility was donated to as a treatment center, and it's not just for alcoholics, it's for all kinds of addictions. And there was this person who used to come up there every other week, and his name was Herb Thompson, and he was an artist, and he had this Mylar screen in facing in such a way that you could see every brush stroke that he put on the paper. And his wife, Rosa, would sit in the back, and they played this music called A Fairy Ring. And I would watch, we would watch him paint these things. And, you know, what Herb Thompson did was made you feel like today, like I'm here and you're out there, that I can't do this without you. And he would, you know, he would just make these beautiful watercolor masterpieces in about 45 minutes, and I got to know Herb as a result of that. I would go back to Harmony and watch him paint, and when I needed my batteries charged, I would go back, and I got to know him personally. And one of the things I did when I got sober was I play music. I play a flute, and I started playing in a local concert band in Loveland, and they would tape the shows, and he actually asked me for a tape of one of the shows, you know, to like, and I was so honored to hear, because this guy, this man was a beautiful artist, and his thing wasn't alcoholism, he was more suicidal, and depression was his problem. But, you know, that's, you know, the spirituality started for me there. Came to believe God is everything or God is nothing, and God is you and God is me, and I hear God speaking to me through other people. We talked about this earlier. It's one of the reasons I'm up here. There are many paths to the top of the mountain, and I've chosen to try and take a little bit of the good from all of them. I recently read a book called The Purpose-Driven Life, and it was a very Christian-oriented book with a lot of quotes from the Bible in it. And when I substituted Alcoholics Anonymous for the church, the basic church thing, I found that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a purpose-driven life, because every time I reach out to try and help someone, I get that much more back from, I get my sobriety that way. I'm a recovering Catholic also. And, you know, that was, I survived 12 years of Catholic school. And, you know, that for me, I was very spiritually bankrupt when I got here. That none of that seemed to make any sense to me when I was younger. And, you know, today I find that the religious part of this, there are really a lot of good people following religious, spiritual lives, but I really like the way Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to, the freedom to pursue it however I feel that it should be done. I really like the fact that, you know, when I look out here and see all these faces, you know, I am you and you are me, And we're all in this together, and it gives me a real deep feeling. You know, the meeting last night was just that. I mean, that's why I'm here. You know, this is like we all seem to come together for these things, and to hear Judy Collins sing "Amazing Grace" just brought tears to my eyes last night, and And that's the kind of feeling that this whole fellowship provides for me. I also read a book called Beyond Fear, and Beyond Fear was about that this person really put the God is everything and God is nothing. I mean, God is this glass. God is the water in this glass. God is this rug. I mean, if you're going to say God is everything or God is nothing, I mean, we have to take this literally. God is everything. The mountains, the trees, you know, the tiny little bugs. And that, for me, keeps it real simple. It keeps it so that I can see God everywhere. I mean, God is the air we breathe. Don't take the air we breathe for granted. Every time you take a breath, you know, that's God putting life into your body. And we're supposed to be, to love God, and in turn He loves us. And, you know, that this can be taken to, you know, to any level. And I found that the longer I'm sober, the more it means to me. I was at a memorial service. Well, when last time Rebecca was in town, I went to her home group meeting in Denver, her old home group, and just so happened that one of the women there was selling these CDs of Don P. I don't know, Don, there may be people in here that know who Don P was, and he was a delegate back in 1981. And one of the things that Don P did every winter was to have a big book study up in Estes Park, and he would go there and spend the whole weekend there. And I started going to this when I was really newly sober, and Don really touched my life. You know, they say stick with the winners, and I choose to surround myself with people who believe like I believe. And Don had a very practical mind about spirituality. He had a lot of Indian artifacts in his house because he had kind of a Native American background. And one of the things he would do is if you came into his house and admired something that was on the wall, he would give it to you, and knowing that it was going to be replaced tenfold. And so Don had that kind of an attitude, and he had a peace of mind about him that I always truly admired. And then you start seeing other people that feel the same way. And the more I stay with these people, the more I learn from them, the more I realize that that's who I want to be. He had what I wanted. And it was really sad. There was hundreds of people at this memorial service. He was really loved by a lot of people. And I went to, it was, the longer you stick around here, the more memorial services you get to go to. Another friend of mine, it was just last Friday that I was there. We called him Big Bill. And Big Bill always talked about his higher power as the big guy. And Bill was dying of a terminal disease. And we had started this meeting for Jack. Jack had a liver transplant and was then bitten by a West Nile mosquito and almost died. He spent 3 months in a coma. And I never thought I was going to see my friend Jack again. Well, they brought him back to Fort Collins from Denver and put him in a rehab place. And we started taking meetings into the rehab place, and Big Bill showed up. That was the first time I ever met this person. A big, fuzzy kind of guy, you know, that just, you know, you just automatically were drawn to. And Big Bill was in a lot of pain and then dying from some kind of cancer. I don't even remember what it was. But, you know, what I really loved about him was his peace of mind. And when you start talking about the big guy, you know, you would just sit there and listen and shake your head because Bill had it. Bill had that peace of mind. I think that peace of mind is the most important part of this program. Peace of mind, whatever it takes. You know, we cease fighting anything and everyone. And once you let that go and try and follow the spiritual path, I mean, that's, to me, one of the most powerful parts of this whole fellowship is the fact that that we get to live that life. And then it turns into gratitude. You know, the more you have, the more you get. And I'm really, really grateful that this has happened to me here today. This has been really, I'm really honored. And thank you all. That's all I have.
Thanks, Jim. A couple things I was just thinking about. When I was, I guess, about 11, I started running. And I really loved running. And I started running track, and I started running cross country. And then I started drinking. And then I kept running for a while, and I kept drinking, and then it kind of went like that. And when I was 16, I got caught drunk by a coach of the swim team, and I got kicked off the cross-country team. And my response, which I think is pretty alcoholic, was, okay, fine, I don't care. You know, didn't mean anything to me anyway, fine, screw it, I'm done, fine. And so I didn't run again or exercise pretty much at all for about 7 to 10 years. And then I got sober. And then I met Jim. And Jim was really an inspiration to me. He's run many marathons. And I started, you know, once I had, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I started running a little bit. And I, you know, I was doing like 3 miles at a time, and I had to stop for a break in the middle. And I went to this Fellowship of the Spirit conference in Colorado with Jim, and I said to him, you know, you're really inspiring to me. Maybe someday I can do something like you. Maybe I could run a marathon before I'm 30. And he said, why don't you run one before you're 28? And I said, huh, all right. And I did. And I've run 3 marathons now, and I'm training for my 4th marathon. And just like getting sober and just like being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I have you with me, or if I have running friends with me, if I have people with me helping me, I can do anything. I can run a marathon. I can't run one by myself, but if I have people with me, I can do it. And just like this, I can't, you know, I tried to not drink by myself so many times. I cannot do it. But if I hang out with you guys, all of a sudden I have 8 years. Who knew? Yeah, really great. One other thing I was just thinking about is that, you know, the book talks about our little plans and designs, and I have a couple of those. You know, I have ideas about what I want my family to be like, and what I want my house to be like, and what I want my career to be like. But I think the best one that I have is that I want to live to be 100. And have 79 years of sobriety. Wouldn't that be so awesome? Get up there and be that little old lady with a big book giving it to the guy with 4 days with 79 years of sobriety. I really want to live to be 100 for that. The last thing I want to tell you before I introduce our last speaker is that, you know, I don't, different groups do different things, but there is that thing that you hear about, you know, if people had told me that I needed to, like, you know, do cartwheels down the main avenue of my city naked to get sober, I would have done it, you know, these things, the pushing the peanut with your nose and all that stuff. Well, this man, in sobriety, has worn a tutu for an AA function. That is what this man will do to stay sober. And he was sharing with me before that he was a little nervous, so I hope I've just taken all the wind out of that for him. So from Toledo with 16 years, this is Timmy.
Isn't it time for a smoke break? Wait. Well, hello, my name's Tim Ackley. I'm an alcoholic. You know, this is definitely a privilege and honor, and I want to thank Charlie for really getting on my case about making sure I have a tie. And to clean up myself, you know, when I'm asked to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because it's a privilege and an honor, you know, and it's not only cleaning up the inside, but it's time to clean up the outside, you know, and that's what I had to do, and I needed people to tell me that. And, you know, and I'm thankful for that. I want to thank everybody for being here, not only the Toledo crew, but everybody else, you know, because you're here for me. And I thank you for that. And it's just awesome. And tell you what, you know, the nervousness is still here. I'm just... The story with that thing of being asked to do this was just like, you know, I never believed in my wildest dreams I'd be in Toronto talking to all these people and thinking, my God, you know, this never... It would never came unless I worked the steps, go to meetings, and not pick up a drink. And the thing happened was I did this skit in a state convention, and I had this guy come up and ask me about talking on a panel in Toronto. I thought he was kidding. I had no clue this guy's asking me about talking on a panel. I was like, oh, yeah, sure, not a problem. You know? 2 months ago, I get this letter in the mail asking me if I'd do it. I'm thinking, man, I don't think he was kidding. First, but you know, this is my third international. I'll tell you what, man, this is fantastic. It just gives me goosebumps, you know, to be part of something like this, and it's awesome. You know, if I wasn't willing to do the things that them people told me when I first come around, which I did them half measures, and just stick around and find out what it had to offer. You know, I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 22, you know, and I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I wasn't sick. I wasn't like you people. You had problems. I didn't have them problems. You know, and I didn't realize that the spiritualness was just out of me until I heard this one gentleman tell me one time that, you know, Timmy, it's not what you drank or how much you drank. It's how it affected you and your life and the people around you. And, you know, and that's stuck with me ever since because that's so true. You know, I loved everything about alcohol. I enjoyed it. It made me something that I dreamed I'd be, but I never dreamt it would take me to those places that I went. And I never dreamt that it would make me the person I was, you know. And the steps, you know, allowed me to be in a place like this and put me in people's lives again and allow me to be happy and to be part of somebody, you know. And it's awesome, I guess, to get me back, Timmy back. And that's where the spirituality comes in. And I went through a Catholic school, heard about all this God stuff, knew I was going anyway to downstairs, and because I was already doing all that stuff, I was already sinning, I was already a mean individual is what it was. And see, I drank with my father. My father wasn't my father, he was my friend. And I did all kinds of stuff with that man. And you know, so when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, now don't mind me jumping around back and forth now. But when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, when I first come around, I was nuts. I was crazy. I was insane. I bounced off the walls. I still went to meetings, but I was still insane. I was still crazy. You know, but I kept coming back. And I would be defiant. And I wouldn't talk at meetings. I still didn't trust you people. Didn't want really too much of what you had, but, you know, I went through a treatment facility, never heard of AA before, and when I went to my first AA meeting, I was really scared and terrified because they took me to a meeting that was like, this was like on the outskirts of Toledo, this place called Mommy, and I was scared because they took me to this church that was like a couple blocks away from this bar I used to drink at, and I thought somebody was going to see me. I was that important, as I thought, and I was so nervous, you know. I couldn't tell you the person that got up and shared their experience, strength, and hope. I couldn't tell you if it was a man or a woman. All I know is somebody was at that door, and they said, "Welcome, it's nice to see you." You know, just little things like that, man. That's what really gets me to keep coming back around the rooms. And just little things, just little spiritual things, man. And it's the people that are there that God puts in my life. And that's what I had to do, you know. Like I say, you know, I don't believe I came from an alcoholic home, a dysfunctional family. They had a dysfunctional son, is what it comes down to. It was me. Nobody made me drink. I drank because I loved it and I enjoyed it. And it took me away from me. You know, it seemed like when I consumed, it was all bets were off on what was going to happen next. The worst possible jail I had was the thing on top of my shoulders. You know, that was the prison that I could not get out of, that scared me to death. You know, and with that father, you know, I became a son to that man. You know, and it took working the 12 steps and grabbing a hold of a person called a sponsor. And this little story I like to talk about being about sponsors is it happened in San Diego. At the International Convention in San Diego, you know, it was like my first one. I was like in awe. It was like, oh, wow, this is awesome, man. This is cool. You know, I never flew before. I flew to California. I was like, man, that's so cool. And I'm on this bus. And it was like, previous to this, my sponsor passed away. So, you know, I was without a sponsor. And I thought it was okay because I had a home group. And I had this thing called support group that I can hang out with, but I didn't have a sponsor anymore. And I figured, well, I'll hold off and not get one for a while. And I was on a bus coming back from Tijuana. And, you know, the bus is like the subway was. You know, everybody's holding it. It's packed full. And I got all these people. And they were talking this, you know, everybody's talking sobriety, got their badges on. Everybody's having fun. And the word came up about sponsorship, you know, and I'm kind of mumbling, you know. And I mumbled, I think, a little too loud, and Charlie heard me saying something about without a sponsor, and he looks at me, and he gives me this look like, what? And then before I know it, man, I mean, I'm on a couple blocks of having my inventory taken, and I could not get away. And what really got me is it was like all these people on this bus, I got one drunk guy looking at me saying, Timmy, look at me, I'm without a sponsor. You know, I'm thinking, Jesus. Was I willing to believe that one? It scared me so much that, you know, Charlie said he gives me a week, you know, or he was going to sign me his sponsor. And I was like, oh, okay. But no, Charlie's a very good and dear friend of mine, you know, and I'm really glad he showed up because it means a lot to me. And, you know, it was the people, you know, that just kept me coming around. You know, I've done a lot of, how we say it, human things. You know, I've messed up in my life. I've done goofy things. Like I said, you know, I became a son to my father, you know, and when he passed away, it was really interesting. I tell this one quite a bit, too, about when my father passed away. I looked at what the unconditional love in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous shows me, that these people were there for me. They were there at the funeral home. To me, it was awesome. You know, it was just, like I say, it's that little spiritual stuff like that really just gets me. And I was sitting at the funeral home, and when I went and buried my father, you know, everybody was asking me if I was okay and if I needed to talk and just call him. And it's like, I'm all right. And it was snowing. It was around in January. And I was out shoveling my walk, and I was shoveling the guy behind my house, and I went in. And they had a thing that flashed on the news. You know, they usually tell you, you know, when it gets really bad on snowing, stuff flashes on the bottom of the screen and tells you this place is closed because you can't get on the streets. And they had a thing flash across the screen that said all AA meetings are canceled. I'm thinking, you gotta be kidding me. You know, I'm thinking my dad, you know, because my father, he still did his, I'm not saying he's an alcoholic, he worked on his lead till the day he died. And you know, and I'm thinking, boy, he must have a good sense of humor to tell me something like this. Now, this weekend's just been awesome. You know, last night was just fantastic. My arm got tired because I had my video camera for the flag ceremony. I'm thinking, man, this is just awesome. And to me, it was awesome that one man came out without his flag. You know, that was awesome, man. I was like, yeah! That was awesome. Of course, course, the bagpipes just really broke me up, man. I was like, geez. And it's hard for me to just kind of start babbling, man. And I felt like this all morning. And like I say, you know, like June, he gets it on the spur of the moment. He ain't got time to think, you know. God, I've had 2 months to hear. Oh, God. You know, I'm not a person that can write down notes and read and stuff like that. You know, I just try to talk from the heart and see what God's got to flow through me. And about this program and the people, you know, the new people, the people that were there before me, I wouldn't be able to have that. You know, 70 years. It's just, you know, I got sober February 24th of 89, and when I sat in that unit and they had these people called volunteers come up and they're telling us, you know, there's like 35 of us in this unit, and they said, well, maybe two of you might stay sober in 5 years. Sitting there, I knew, I believed in myself that I wasn't going to stay sober. I wasn't going to be one of those two. I had all intentions of getting drunk when I left that place. And the willingness hit. They call it a key. You know, the key of willingness. I had this key of willingness, but my door key was like this small and the key was this big. And I didn't know how to open it. No clue at all. There's still times I still bounce off the walls and I just kind of, I don't sit and listen. You know, and I got to stop and smell the flowers, they would say. And, what was it? You got to be as willing as dying to hear what you need to hear, you know. And the steps and the people in the rooms allow me to stop and smell the flowers. And they let me know, Timmy, slow down a little bit. I try to stay as active as I possibly can. You know, the best of my ability. I love to stand at the door at my home group, which is Perrysburg Stay Sober. Meets at 6:30. And I just love that meeting, except when the air conditioner's running, you can't hear nobody. But I love to stand at the door and welcome people because, you know, that's part of me. I had to learn to start loving people and enjoying people, and I had to have that. And that's what I really love. My first home group, I thought to myself, you know, well, boy, they must really know who I am and how important I am. And I really enjoyed this one guy that always stood at the door and shook my hand and said, hi, Timmy, it's good to see you. How you doing? He'd ask me how my week was going. And I was like, wow, this guy really likes me, man. This is pretty cool. So I figured I'd join his home group. Now, this meeting was probably maybe 100, 200 people show up. And that's big in Toledo. That's a big meeting. And they smoked in the meeting. And I liked the guy until I joined the group and he told me I had to clean the ashtrays. I didn't like him after that. But, you know, I did it. I stayed there and I cleaned the ashtrays and I mumbled and I grumbled and I complained under my breath and I thought to myself, but, you know, the man would stand in the kitchen and talk to me. And he would just talk to me. And there might be another guy with him talking to him. And I started listening. And I guess that key got a little smaller. And it started getting smaller and smaller. And that's where I guess I opened the door. And I allowed things to happen in my life. You know, sobriety's been very good to me. It's been awesome. You know, I wouldn't trade any money, anything in the world, you know, what AA has given me. You know, but what can I give for AA? You know, and that's what the theme is talking about. I am responsible. You know, and that's the thing, man. I got to be responsible. The 12 steps teach me to be part of society instead of a menace to society. Tells me to be a human being again, you know, instead of a madman. And the people in the rooms can teach me that, you know, but I can go right off track a little bit, you know, and I start becoming a fruitcake and I become fruity, and it's like, man, I just start bouncing off the walls, and because I still got a little gerbil that can run in my head and get that wheel turning. And yes, I do have a sponsor. And I do have a home group. And I'm on a committee in Toledo. And that's what keeps me in AA. Somebody said it earlier today at a meeting about being in the middle of the bed, you know, instead of on the outskirts and maybe bouncing on the edge of the bed. You know, I can bounce in the middle and I'm not going to fall off. And but if I do fall off, somebody always picks me up, dusts me off, says it'll be all right. Somebody said that, you know, here I come to Toronto to talk and I got all these Toledo people follow me. It's a good thing, though. I mean, that's a good thing. And it's cool. Like I say, man, this is just, God, it's awesome, man. I mean, never in my wildest dreams I thought somebody would ask me to come to an international and talk. Never. I always thought I'd just be the outskirts, you know, and nobody will notice me, and I'll just kind of... But then again, my dance partner gets me out there in a tutu, so... And I'm drawing a blank. So, you know, usually a lot of times when you do that and the meeting goes over earlier, you know, the court slip people love that. They're like, yeah, it's over, you know. But, you know, thank you, everybody, for being here for me. I really appreciate that. And God bless.
To all our speakers, and thanks for my sobriety. And now if you'll join me, I'd like to close with a responsibility statement. Is everybody linked up? Okay. I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. Keep coming back. Works for you.